Latter-day Saint Home Educators is pleased to bring you this audio presentation, recorded live during the May 2012 Home Education Conference held in Fredericksburg, Virginia.
Okay. I have two microphones here. I didn't adjust this. Oh, well. Can you hear me? Good morning. I know there's the few, the proud, the special needs parents. I'm thankful that y'all got up early enough. That's why I said, you know, special needs being done first thing in the morning, you know that they'll be here. Since I knew there'd probably only be some of us, I wanted to open up to ask you what type of special needs child that you came here for, so that I know that I'm going to maybe specifically address some of those needs that you have, as well as feel free to ask questions throughout, because when you come to something like this, you really want your questions answered, and I want to try and do that. So if anyone could tell me the different special needs you have. So global developmental delays, mainly a speech delay, although speech delays can often impact your social and impact your behavior.
Mm-hmm. I have a 13-year-old with autism.
13-year-old with autism. So 2-year-old with Down syndrome, 16-year-old Asperger's, and possibly something else with an 8-year-old. Okay. Any other diagnoses out there, or we've covered them? ADHD, 9-year-old, okay. Did you come to my right brain class?
Yes.
Good.
I have ADHD.
Okay, so Asperger's and ADHD. Okay, so autism and fetal alcohol syndrome. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we've got a lot of variety out there, and that's exactly what happens, isn't it? And that's the same thing that happens when you end up having your children go to school, because as much as they say that they have special needs classes, and there could only maybe be 5, 6, or 7, right? But they're going to be so different, and their needs are so different, and sometimes, like Asperger's, don't fit into a nice, neat category because they have that intelligence, but they have all these social and behavioral needs that need to be supported, and schools just aren't, to me, equipped to holistically take care of all the needs. So I'm going to do a little presentation, and then make sure, like I said, if you have questions as I go, feel free to ask them. I'm going to try to definitely leave some time at the end. Let's see, we go to 9:30, right? So I'm going to try and keep track of that. All right. I love the title of this conference being What Mattered Most. And I'm really at that stage. As you see, a lot of my children are adults now. Including my special needs, I have two of my three major special needs. No, two of my four. So half are adults now. Adam, he's 19. He has autism, and he's moderately verbal, high behavior. He'll always have to live with someone. Alex, he's still at home. He's 17. He's high-functioning autism, but he needs quite a few supports. Eli, he's serving a mission right now in California. He had to do a 3-month trial mission first to prove that he was capable. And he was approved to have been capable. He's been out 14 months and doing well. And then there's William. He's adopted and came to us with pervasive developmental delays, starting with language, and then I saw that how much that impacted everything else, but also had a lot of memory issues and attention issues, some serious memory issues. His IQ came out to 40 because his two memory scores were 0. So I knew that there was going to be some big problems there. I have ADHD with Joseph, my youngest. I've got bipolar for my oldest. And so I live with quite a spectrum of differences. And then there's the handsome husband. So I have eight children now. One by, you know, what is it? Five by birth, two by adoption, and one by marriage. So it's an interesting life. So I'm at the stage that I'm just so pleased with how everything has turned out that I'm just really at a reflective stage, and I want to give talks on what mattered most when you're through it all. What really mattered? What did I do that really mattered? And the first thing that I did that really mattered was the strengths and weakness paradigm. You know, in school, I gotta find my spot with my. In school, it's a generalist education, which means they're actually weakness based. So what they do is they have a checklist for first grade, and they say, these are the things you're supposed to know in first grade. So they'll go through the checklist with your child. Does he know this? Check. Which probably is a strength, but it gets checked, which means we don't have to concentrate on that anymore. It's done. Okay, these things you don't know how to do, not check. So we're going to now concentrate on those, which are their weaknesses usually. So they're actually really a weakness-based environment in school, but I feel like my typical children, it was really important for me to have them have a strengths-based environment, because to me, my belief system as an LDS person is that we've all been given talents that we're supposed to develop, every single one of us, and that's what's going to bless the world and those around us is our talents. Our weaknesses are there for our personal growth, and so we do need to work on them, but if that's what we're concentrating on, then we're not blessing the world. And guess what? Our special needs children can bless the world too, and they have strengths too, and I wanted to concentrate on those. And if you go to the first one, I have some of the examples. So Eli, my son with high-functioning autism, he loved trains. And so he played with trains a lot of his day. You know, in the special needs arena, you think, okay, they have special needs. They're behind the eight ball. We really have to double up on doing all their weaknesses. Yes and no. I believe in 60% of the time they're going to be doing their strengths because they need to feel good about themselves. And this is a kid at 11 years old and said, I'm just so talented. I don't know what I should do when I grow up. And that's what I want for every one of my kids. I want them to know that they have their strengths. So going on, you know, he did that. He did all the building. He's my builder, whoever came to my right brain class. And so he was doing Lego all the time. Didn't have any friends. And one time, traditionally speaking, someone asked him, do you have friends? Yes. You have a best friend? Yes. Well, who is it? My Legos. And they went, oh. And I went, no, oh. Really, he's happy. He loves his Legos. They're his best friend. He had imaginary friends that came off of his Legos, and that's a right brain trait. So sometimes you have to sift through what's who they are and what's autism. And that was just, that was a right brain trait, not an autism trait going on. So more building, continue. Three-dimensional puzzles. So here's this kid that could barely speak. When he spoke, he was very disordered. He always had language, but he was very disordered. So he'd say things. I remember thinking, man, I understand every single word he said, but nothing made sense when you put it all together. But he could build 3D models going on. And he loved mazes, and so he was developing some drawing too, because always a train. There was always a train in it going on. But then he'd develop it, and that, you know, he'd get better and better. And you know, these are skills I was seeing. So yeah, he had all these weaknesses, but he also had some amazing strengths. And I wanted to make sure that was first and foremost going on. I discovered this with Lincoln Logs. I walked into the room. He had taken his Lincoln Logs and put numbers. I thought, I think this kid might end up good in math. I want to keep going with that. So, and in fact, I always say today, English is not his primary language. Math is. Math and computers is his primary language, and English is his secondary language. And it's still true to this day at 21 years old. When he speaks, he has to think about it. And yet, mind you, he's on a mission. And what do they do all day on a mission? Is speak and teach. And he, and I'll share that. I guess I'll share it as I go. At 11 to 13, you have a brain shift. Everyone does, and even our special needs children, and you'll really see a big difference with your special needs children. That's when they become aware if they're of their place in the world. And it was at 12 he said, "Mom, I think people know things I'm supposed to know." And I said, "Yeah, they do. Would you like to know them?" "Yeah." And it was this lack of awareness. He also said, "I notice the church members don't play with me." You know, the youth, he was in young men then. He said, "They never offer to play with me. How come?" I said, "Yeah, that's true." I said, "You want to know why?" I said, "Because all this time you've ignored them." And they would offer and they'd offer and you'd reject and you reject. Well, after a while, it's human nature to stop offering. So it's not because they were bad kids. I said, "It's because you chose not to do that and they accepted that. And so then you just became this person that was always there." I said, "If you want to change that, it's now your responsibility to change that. Let me show you how." And so he did. And so he really started being aware of his weaknesses and wanted to work on them. But he had a foundation of strengths. All the way to 11 years old, we did a lot of strengths. And he knew, that's why I said at 11, 12, he said, "I'm so talented, I don't know what I want to do when I grow up." So he had that foundation. So when he worked on all these strengths or weaknesses that most of us don't have to work on, he was prepared to do that and work hard and not feel bad about himself. And in so much that he got so good that he could serve a mission. Okay, go on. He also loved math young. He was doing pentominoes and stuff. So he had his own way of doing it. Go on. And he has math things. I'm going to skip that. Go ahead. More. Okay, this is Adam. Adam is my 19-year-old that's always going to have to live with someone. His IQ falls in the mentally retarded area. It's a little complicated when we talk about autism, though, because autism is not like Down syndrome. Down syndrome kids, they want to be like everybody else. They're aware of that, and they want to be like everyone else, but they're just delayed. They're just not as quick as everybody else. Autism doesn't mean they necessarily want to be like everybody else. In fact, my son Alex, he always says, "I do not want to be a normal head." That's what he calls us. Because he likes being autistic. And he has certain things he likes, and he thinks it would be very boring to be a normal head. So it's a little trickier. But he couldn't speak at 3.5 years old when he was the first one diagnosed and realized that there was differences. And so I had to figure out how he learned. And he learned to read before he spoke because he loved the alphabet. That was his perseverative thing. And so I thought, well, if he likes the alphabet so much and he really is unreliable in hearing how to speak, maybe if he learned how to read, I could write out what he's supposed to say and it would be more reliable. And sure enough, he's very good at patterns. And so that's another thing. You say, okay, so here's Eli that you could see is good at, you know, Legos and all that in your traditional. But Adam, you know, he was good at numbers and letters. That's what he liked. But then he couldn't speak and didn't seem to be able to do anything with it. So you got to look beyond. He loved patterns and he loved matching. That's what he did, puzzle matching all day long. So I thought, let's go with that. Let's teach him how to read by matching. So I found a book and I made cards and we matched them. He started learning to read. So there's always strengths to look for. Going on. I tore books apart. I'd get two books and tear them apart, picture and words, and have them put them together for comprehension. Next one. He loved math, so we'd do abacus, we'd do calculators. He just loved to input that, and so I would just go with those strengths. And he still loves to do homeschool, even at 19, because he loves that pattern and that sameness. He learned to spell really early, and we just did matching. I got this hangman game, and I created my own little flashcards because he needed the pictures, and I'd have a match. And if he matched them 10 times in a row, he just knew how to spell them. It was just how he was. That was a strength for him. So at 5 years old, when he could spell and none of the other kids could, or when he could read and none of the other kids could, that gave him something to say, hey, this kid has something even though he can't speak. Hangman, because I wanted tiles, and they had tiles that could be set up, you know, like Scrabble, they're all in a mess.
Right.
So this was a hangman game that had a little tray, so it was perfect. And they had two trays, two hangman trays, so I had, now they're all lost, but at the time I'd set this up and I created this, and I thought, I need to market this. I never did. I just made my own little thing that and that's what it is. You have to be creative. Create your own stuff, see what their strengths are, and do more of that. And then it shows other kids that, hey, even though they're different than me, they have some strengths too. And I remember I always made the people surprised. Going on. Alex was my ceiling fan guy. So even at 1 year old, he started looking at ceiling fans. Well, he continued to like ceiling fans. But after a while, let's see if going on, he started doing architecture programs. That, you know, he had to learn to speak. He started finally speaking about 5 or 6 years old. And so this is, he probably started this when he was 10, 11, 12, doing the house building plans. Because he would, at 6, 7, and 8, he'd go look at house plan books when we'd go grocery shopping. That's what he wanted to buy, not candy, a house plan book, because they had ceiling fan things on it. And so then I got him going on architecture, and so now he likes to build houses. Will he become an architect? Will he become a house planning person? Will he install the fans in new houses? Because my husband would go around the new builds with him. That was their fun thing to do, go around new builds, and so he could see where the ceiling fans were going to go. So there's always something you can do. No, he's not building real houses. Yes, he's just doing plans. Okay, going on. We got him his first ceiling fan for Christmas, and we didn't have electricity yet and put it in this bunk bed. Hey, they're already outside the box. Go outside the box. He was thrilled. He got to be right, because he was in the basement with a drop ceiling, so I couldn't have a ceiling fan in his room, so we put one in his bunk bed. And he would sit there all night. Okay, going on. And then he started collecting ceiling fans. As he got older, he started earning money to collect ceiling fans, and he started hanging out at the Habitat for Humanity Restores that they bring in the old ceiling fans. And he saw and met another person with autism who was volunteering at the Habitat to repair the ceiling fans. And so he started learning to do electricity, and now he hooks up his, our whole garage is his ceiling fan room, and he hooks up all the electricity and all of his ceiling fans. So these little perseverative interests, if you expand them, those are his, that's where their strengths are. Because most kids with autism, for instance, are right brain. And so this is electronics. So you all see where their typical hook is. So I just kept expanding it instead of just having him sitting, because that's what he likes to do. And he still likes to do that. But he now does a lot of other things. He's motivated to make money. We're thinking that he might open up a little e-store and sell and trade ceiling fans. He already sells and trades ceiling fans. There are actually ceiling fan forums. They had a ceiling fan symposium in Louisiana that he went to with my husband. I said, okay. A bunch of ceiling fan geeks. Now, how many of these people are on the spectrum? I would have to think a lot. But, you know, there is a business out there. You know, Dan's Fans, that's a business. That's actually a nationwide business. Maybe he'll own a Dan's Fans. Going on. So now he wires them up. Go ahead. And he draws, because drawing is not easy for kids with autism. A lot of special needs kids have a hard time with the handwriting, don't they? And so he was no exception. But now he does this at 16, 17. He'll choose to draw fans. He wants to draw them. And he'll, as you see, they're racing meticulously. That's not right. You know, and they get wanting it right. So he actually will draw, and he'll cut them out. And that cutting was still a poor skill. Go on. Then there's William. He's my imaginative kid. He's the one that's global delays, a lot of memory issues. But he had that imagination, so I saw that. That's the only thing I could see, is that he had this imagination, but he couldn't do a lot with it. I actually had to teach him to play more. I taught him community helpers, and that's when he really started going into his imaginative play, going on. More imaginative play. They love they're very active, very ADHD, very, you know, soldiers, Indians. So this is I guess he's supposed to be someone, he's guarding him. I know he was a president once when Obama became president. He was the president, and Joseph was his bodyguard, going on. He loves Indian stuff, so he's always in costume. And at 13, he will still go and get in costume every day, in very authentic costumes. And I don't buy the stuff. He makes them, which goes to impulsivity. He's got impulsivity issues, and I've never had a child with impulsivity issues. I've heard about it, and now I get to experience it. So when he sees something that he wants, and he just can't stop himself from getting it. Like my vintage Mrs. Beasley doll. He saw her costume and thought that was a really good costume for something he wanted. And I go in, it's cut. Son, why did you tell me I could have gone and gotten fabric for you? But Impulsivity is, I need it and I don't have any stops. I don't know how to put stops on it. He's gotten much better. It used to be when he was younger, 10 times a day, he'd have something that he's destroyed because he can't think beyond what he's doing in front of him. And every time I'd see it, I'd go, "Ah, William, what is this?" And finally I said, "Why am I surprised every time I find something that he has done? Because shouldn't I say, oh, he's impulsive? I should, oh, there's the thing that he did today." Now he does it maybe once a week at 13, so it's come a long way from 10 times a day to once a week. I had to hide all scissors, all knives, because he would use those to destroy things, and I was just not so sure what he might do. I still hide fire starting things. All right, going on. That's his Indian thing. And he wore paint, so I'm thinking, honey, you're going to the Young Men tonight. You might want to wash that off. I have gone to the store with him looking like an Indian. Not that much like an Indian, though. Going on. He made a teepee, so then we start expanding, you know, things that he can do. Going on. He loves nature, so that's another thing. He loves nature. He's always catching things. Go on. He's a food person, so cooking, I really expanded his cooking because he's constantly eating. That was kind of a sensory thing and an impulsive thing and an anxiety-releasing thing because chewing is relaxing. All right, next. And he started doing photography, and I thought this was pretty good. He has some strengths. I had to look for those and really, go ahead, there's a couple more. You can just flip through it. So he'd gone to the zoo and done some photography, and I thought he did a pretty good job. So I'm going to encourage that kind of thing. So that was the most important thing I did. If I'm going to say the most important thing, that is it. Find your child's strengths. Everyone has them. You have to find them and expand them. Even if they, in the world of the special needs that you're living in, they'll say, like with autism, well, it's perseverative, it's self-stimulatory. Well, so you say. I say that's the beginning of what they, you know, they may not be able to expand it without your supports, but go in there and support them then. They may, with William, he's a natural right brain person, but with his 2 months prematurity, something happened to his right side. So he couldn't draw, actually skip down all the way to the, there's some drawings. His coloring. Yeah. He couldn't color. And this is even at, I think this was at even 8 years old. Abby helped me, and she hand over handed helped him. And I know drawing, we started at 4 or 5 years old and hand over hand because he couldn't even draw a line. And we hand over handed him. And at first he's all like, no, no, you know, because they're like, they don't like that kind of help because he has a lot of social cognition, but he had no ability to do things. So we just had to kind of say, listen, let us do this. Just let us do this a little bit and see what happens. And then he started being able to do it. He started off with this and go to the next one. And then he ended up with this because he started loving it because it was a natural love for him. I knew it was a natural space. He just didn't have the ability. And to have your own strengths be limited because of your disability is a really hard thing. And he's really my first one I really saw that with. But we helped him hand over hand. Then we would help him, you know, whatever we needed to do to support him. And now he does this. The next one, same with drawing. This was a stencil. So we start with stencils. We started with hand over hand. We started with something that could be successful. And we also went to tracing, and he still does tracing because he'll get really mad. I mean, he'll blow up into a behavior when he can't do it. And he'll, this is stupid. I hate that. All this junk comes out of his mouth because he's got a lot of behavioral things. He's probably going to be bipolar as well. So he's got a lot of these very aggressive reactions. So we say, okay, if you're frustrated, just tell me this isn't working because I can help and work with you. So, you know, that's the things that we had to work on. But going on, so then he went, and this is a free draw. So he went, and this kid couldn't draw a line at 5. This is probably 11 years old. It took him that long. And the next one, and then this is another free draw. So, you know, something, no, is he age appropriate if he was to be an artist? No, but for him, this is a huge progress and he loves doing it. And so that's another way I had to find his strength, even though it was a weakness. I knew it was a hidden strength that his disability had encumbered him. So I had to notice that.
Mm-hmm. When we get to that frustration point, because I think that's where we experience a halt. Even though they love what they're doing,
mm-hmm.
they just get to that.
Overload. Yeah, yes.
And then they want to give up, they want to quit. You know, how do you work through that period or that stage?
Mm-hmm. And that is number two. That is my second most thing that mattered most. And I'm telling you right now, my four, academics is number four. It was not number one. That's the last thing on my list.
Sorry, can I jump back really fast
mm-hmm.
to this?
Yep.
How do you find those hidden strengths? I mean, like with your son, why didn't you just say, oh, he can't draw, that's a weakness?
Mm-hmm.
How did you know that was a hidden strength?
Because I knew he was very imaginative. You know, every child is imaginative, right? Every child is imaginative. But with a right brain child, there's an extra measure that you see. I saw with his costuming, and when he'd start learning dress up, I saw he took that beyond normal. And I also, at a very young age, he was really interested in plants. And I thought that was so unusual for, he's such a boy. And yet he liked plants, you know, and I'm like, okay. He's a garden person. He liked to work with my husband in the garden. And so I thought, he's got to be right-brained. He's got to be. So being right-brained, and I knew some things about his birth parents, who was an artist and a musician and stuff, and I watched him. And I could see that he was very interested in watching people draw. He just couldn't do it. So then I suspected, knowing about right brain, left brain, and by that time, because he's number six, I knew a lot about it. And so I was going to make some assumptions and try it. And if it didn't come through, then it wasn't. Same with his food. His food, you know, his food was almost an issue because it was very, he had pica. He was always eating paper, pencils, things like that. Definitely an anxiety thing. But I also saw every so often he'd throw things together into a baggy, nasty-looking mess. I thought, maybe there's a cooking thing there. I mean, sometimes you are just grasping at straws, but you see something that comes across as weird or problematic or part of their, looks like a disability. But I'm looking beyond. You got to look beyond that mark. Because I think that's what people do is just see what they see. But you have to look past that. So that's what I did. I looked past it just like Adam with, okay, he really likes his letters and numbers. And he's always doing puzzles, so he must like matching. And that was part of also knowing about autism, that was something that they could love. I try it, and his eyes lit up. And he couldn't speak, but his eyes went, you know, like that. And I went, oh, this works. Let's do more of that, you know. So, and that's even with typical kids. You know, when my kids were interested in whales, you know, I'm just going to feed more of that. And, well, maybe you might like sharks, too, if you like whales. You know, I'll give you more of that. So it's being aware, being an observer, a keen observer. That's one of the things I think that was made me my most successful as a homeschooler is I watched my kids. I watched what they were doing and what they weren't doing and what they were interested in, even if the smallest thing, even if it was done in an unusual way like the ceiling fans. That's a starting point. So I'd feed that and see what happened. Does that answer your question? I know sometimes I'm pretty good at it, and people will say, okay, do this, and they'll tell me all the things their child's doing, or I'll watch their child, and I'll say, what about that? And they'll go, oh, yeah. I mean, even, you know, someone I remember, you know, a kid would just flip pages. It's all right, they like a visual movement. Let's get some visual movement stuff going. Let's see, you know, get some toys that would do a normal visual movement, see if that interests them. Okay, now the next level, and the next level, because at two, it might just be movement toys. And then by five, it might be something else that goes into, now ceiling fans, and now ceiling fans, you know, you just got to take right where you're at their age appropriate place, and get them something that uses that thing that they're fascinated with. Even if it's simply is moving, why is he always moving pages? Well, some kind of a visual thing, then let's try some of that. Second is that social, emotional, language, behavior thing. From 5 to 10 was the most important thing I did, especially with all my boys. Emotional intelligence, how to be in control of themselves. Because with special needs, and if you have a language difference, like this, you were saying, you know, it can cause behaviors because they're so frustrated that they can't communicate or people aren't understanding them, or it affects their how they play because they go in very differently because they don't know how to do it with language, or they just don't have, they have social differences. So I found language, I did 2 to 4. I did anyone that didn't have language skills, and I had a couple that didn't have any language skills. I did a lot of language teaching at 2 to 4 because that's when you're learning language. I know mentioned the Down syndrome, and you have some of the physical things. That's when typical kids are learning physical things, so I'm probably going to concentrate on physical things, the walking and all that movement stuff, and their language, because I don't care about sometimes the colors and all that stuff. I'm going to care about that they're doing that developmental stage, but they're going to need assistance. Do I have to? I was talking to this lady earlier about special services, you know, whether it's PT, OT, speech, all that stuff. When they're really young, 0 to 3, often they can come to my house. Sure, come to my house. It's not going to be anything off my schedule because they're coming to my house. But it's not rocket science that they're doing. And there's no way your child's going to progress if you have serious delays 30 minutes a day or 30 minutes 3 times a week. You've got to do it. So, as I said, I didn't want to spend time going all the way somewhere, spend 30 minutes, come all the way back, which then becomes 2 hours out of my day and a disruption to our schedule for very minimal benefit. But I might consult. I might do a consultation once a month, have them tell me what they think that child should work on, and I'll work on it, you know, because it's really about just practicing, okay? Every day for pincher grip and stuff, when they're young, we'll do clothespins, or we'll put pennies in a bank, and they're learning pincher grip. I can just do that. Give me those skills, and I'll work on them. Or the PT, you know, I'll do these exercises with the feet. William had toe walking. I have quite a few toe walkers. So they gave us the skills, and we worked on them. And boom, he got better. But I don't have to go there and waste my time every day or even 3 times a week. I did consultations when I could, or sometimes I didn't do it at all because I learned better speech therapy practices with my children than a speech therapist would give me. So behaviors, every behavior has a function. And so you have to decide what the function is, and then they use that behavior because that's all they knew. That's the only skill they knew. So the skill development is so important, but we have to break it down and build it back up so that they understand. And there's just a lot of patience. There's a book called, and I think it's in my Rate Brain handout, there is a resource page, and on that resource page is under parenting, there's a book called How to Really Parent Your Child. Really stupid title. But in that book is a section on anger. And that was such an important, and he has a chart in there that takes you from worse to best for negative ways to express anger and positive ways to express anger, and a little both. And that chart was so useful because it showed me where he was on the chart and where we were going next, because it's not just from going angry and upset and frustrated to wonderful and happy. You know, there's stages of getting there, and it always doesn't look good. You know, if you're hitting to express yourself, having the junk that comes out of your mouth is better than hitting. Even though the junk coming out of the mouth could be, I'm going to kill you, I'm going to bomb this house, and I'm like, oh my gosh, who am I raising here? But that is actually better than that he prevented himself from hitting. So I'm actually going to praise him. Hey, you didn't hit. You know, because that was what we were part of for a long time for some of my kids. Hey, you used your words. I don't like the words you use. Now we're going to have to steer the words. But, you know, there's this process. Also in that book, he tells you what ages are they even capable of learning certain things. Can a 4-year-old who has these difficulties really be at a 12-year-old level? No. You're going to have to wait certain things out, and you can say, at 4, I can help him do this. I'm going to have to be a mentor a lot. I'm going to have to step in and be that advocate for him as he expresses himself and try to help support him so he can do it well. It's a lot of work from us, isn't it, to do that. But in 5 to 7 is when you're doing a lot of the, hey, I'm going to model. And by 8 to 10 is when I start seeing that they can do it half the time. It's like, yes, all that 5 to 7 where I feel like, am I talking to a brick wall? And it's so hard. At 8 to 10, I start seeing it half the time. And then by 11 to 13, 3/4 and more. And it's like, yes, it's working. By 14 to 16, it's all worked out. So that's a lot of time to have to wait. But so important. Because if they can't control themselves and know how to express themselves and not be so frustrated. And that's it. We have to have this success-based environment emotionally as well. And that way, you know, I always was always frustrated when I'd go to part dates. And I always had to follow my child around. We don't get to go talk to the moms. Sorry, we don't. If we really want to, oh, I always get kicked out of this group and that group because my child did this socially and this behaviorally. I'd say, well, mine didn't because I was right next to them. I don't care what they said. I'd explain to them, listen, if I'm not there and I'm just going to be nearby and I've always had my ear, and I'd be right in there. And I'd be saying, hey, hon, come here. Let me talk to you. Or I'd say, oh, how about this? And I'd redirect the situation because I couldn't afford not to be there. And I'd say, can any parent join me? I was very jealous for many, many, many years as I watched the parents who would sit off and do their thing, but I didn't get to. I had to be next to my child. If I was going to be a social mentor, if I was going to be a behavioral mentor in the situation in public, I had to be there. That's when the best teaching opportunities came. I did it at home because home is the best place to really practice. And then I take it out in the public, but I had to be there until they got good. And when I could actually sit back, it was a wonderful time. I'd sit way back, you know, and say, okay, this is as good as I could get. But then there comes a time when you can actually do that. So it is, I just had to educate myself on how to help them behaviorally. I don't know if I can just give you those, unless you give me a very specific situation, I might be able to give you the skill I taught my child. But there is this education that you have to give yourself on how to do that. Get those books, read the books, see how they do it, practice those. And that's what I did. Academics, I did very little academics between 5 and 10, just basics. 11 is when I really hit the major academic time, because there was time for it.
How did you balance other children's academics with that, focusing on behavior?
It's true.
Because we usually try to do family school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Family school doesn't work. It didn't work for my family. I really had a very unschooly approach to things. Everyone was an individual. I never did things as a group, ever. I had 24 hours, you know, 7 days a week. And if each child got 3 days of things, and I'm not talking days, but let's say a couple, 2-3 hours in over 3 days for the week, and that is enough because those kids are still learning. You know, I had my 2 older kids when I had the first diagnosis hit, and we already had a good rhythm going and how they learn for themselves, and I fed. That was what I do. I'd watch what they do, and I'd feed, but I wasn't teaching. I was feeding, and they just would do their thing, and they had each other. And, you know, people will say, and this is, I think this is an important quick story to tell. I remember when the disabilities really hit my house, and people were saying, be careful with the other kids, you know, they're going to need extra attention, and, you know, don't forget them with all the attention you have to give your child. And I'm like, oh, yeah, maybe, but it just didn't feel right either, and I was just really tormented over this whole idea. And then I read this article in the Reader's Digest about a family in Arizona who I figured out was LDS, and they had a child with autism with 2 siblings. And the child went running out the door and ran up one of these big power lines. I don't know if you, or power towers. If anyone heard this story some years ago. And the brother ran after him and climbed the tower, who was petrified of heights, but went after his brother, yelled to his sister, call mom, because she was working. And so she went and called. And he makes it to the top of this power tower. They're very large. And he's hanging on to his brother for dear life because he wants to flap with all the helicopters now flying around for this news story. They're bringing in trucks. They bring in the fire trucks and that can reach. So they had to bring in the power trucks that could reach higher, and they still had to climb to get them. Well, long story short, they did rescue them both safely, brought them down. Of course, the brother was touted as a hero and said, you know, why would you do that? He said, he's my brother. Why wouldn't I do that? And it ends, the article ends, see, I'll cry with these things, is, are you your brother's keeper? Of course. And I said, that's my answer. I will not apologize for the type of children I have. And I'm not going to apologize to their siblings. We're a family. And we love each other. And we support each other. And we're going to apologize for that. And sometimes this person is going to have more attention than this person. And this person is going to have more attention than this person. It all works out over their lifetime. And there was a time when my oldest had all the attention. And then my second had all the attention. And my third and my fourth. Over their 18 years. And it's okay. They know it's not because he's special and I'm not. It's that he needs help and I don't right now. And I always say, fair is not equal. Fair is getting your needs met. That's how fair was. And I'd say, would you like to be this brother instead? And so that you get what he's getting? No, I'd like to be myself. You know, that's all I'd have to say is, because he's getting his needs met and that's what he's getting now. If you'd like to live his life and what he gets and what he doesn't get, then that's okay, I'll let you do that. No, thanks. It quickly changes their opinion on things. And I don't ever really saw too many of my kids getting upset about that. Now, that said, I have a lot of special needs that needed one-on-one. I did use the Medicaid waiver service that's available out there, and brought in people that I trained and that would work with my children. And that was a godsend. I had, when I didn't have those services in the state I was from, I hired college students to work for as volunteers, and they got credit for working for me. I had a PhD person put their master's students with me to do programming in my house, because they love that experience, these college students. I happen to live, luckily, a couple miles from a university. I use university students. I've heard people use their church members, see if anyone, the youth in the church, for personal progress things. Ask them if they'd want to have experience working one-on-one with a child. You're just doing different things. Okay. So there's ways of getting the help. It's true, I couldn't do it all myself, not with all of the kids I have. Maybe if I had one, now in relativity, because of course I only had one, I would have felt that was hard and I probably would have still need help because I don't know the comparison of having three. So, you know, I think, oh, three's hard, so one's easy. Well, if I had one, it's kind of like children, right? When I had two, one was easy, two was hard. When I had five, two is hard, easy, five was hard. So it's all relative. Whenever, I'm sure you get that in grocery stores. Oh my gosh, you have all these kids and I only have one and I feel so bad. It's like, but when I had one, it was hard. It's all relative. And so that was, yeah. And I want to leave some time here at the end. I didn't, you know, my other thing was that I expected more at the appropriate time. 11 to 13, I'd started expecting more. I did a lot of strength-based before then. I did a lot of behavioral and emotional and social mentoring up to that. And then I did a lot more academics and a lot more having them be in charge of knowing. And when she went to the bike riding, I mean, sometimes it's as simple as go to the first bike riding. You know, he didn't know how to ride a bike, but he was getting more independent at 8, 9, and 10. So we got him a special needs bike, and that's when he started, because I knew he'd like a bike, he just didn't have the ability. Go to the next page. That's when we then get the tandem bike, because I knew once he got the breeze in his hair, he would love it. So his dad would always go with him. And of course, you saw he didn't have shoes on, because he was always shoeless. And then he could ride a bike. And it took, and the, you know, he was, I think he was 10 or 11 at that point. So it's never too late. He got more independent, so we went with what his independence was. Eli's independence was that he was going to do his academics more independently, or same with Alex, but his was this. And being independent in his own home, making his own food, you know, taking care of his own room, that was what his independence was. That was a stretch for him. So you have to go, and this is, he now lives with his sister, by the way, his sister and her husband, through an alternative family living arrangement with the Medicaid program, and he loves it. He does not want to come back home. And here he is only partially verbal, and this is his room. And aren't I wonderful? And can't we raise children who will say, yeah, I'll have my brother come live with us. Even though they're being paid, still a lot of people will not do that because that's still a responsibility. And then she married someone who was saying, you know, when they were dating, he was in the back seat with me. I don't know why he was just with me on his own, and I was driving him somewhere. He said, you know, and this was before any of this happened, he said, you know, I know you have all these special needs children and you're not going to live forever. And he said, Abby and I'll make sure to take care of them. I'm thinking, Abby, take him. How many do you find that's like that, you know? And he's an only child. So it's like when you raise your children to say family is important, you know, that's awesome. They live 3 doors down from us. I'm so excited. I don't know how long it'll last, but I'm there. My son lives 2 doors down. Family's so important. And there's somebody in the church that said, we're to be eternal families. We need to practice now. We're not supposed to just say, oh, we're going to be an eternal family and we'll figure that out when in the eternities. We're supposed to practice being eternal families now. And that's why I think they say things like, don't move to Utah. Don't, you know, stay where you are and build up the kingdom where you are, because you're supposed to be building up your own eternal families and your units where you are. And I'm really grateful that I did something right, and I have great kids that are looking out for each other. Even you'd have told me 5 years ago that I'd only have 3 children left in the house with as many special needs children as I have, I would never have believed you. And I only have 3 children left in the house. Like, wow. And yet they're close. I get to see them every day. I get to see Adam, because there's no way I'd send Adam far away. You know, that's the only reason we let him go, even to my daughter's house, is because they're close. He's close. And he's just as much in my eternal family as anything. I know, that's my little Mona Lisa autism picture. Any other questions? Well, when I found, I've had 3 toe walkers. One is, when they were young, I could still see they went flat. They could go flat. So it didn't concern me all that much, but maybe I should have been. William, I didn't realize, I mean, I knew he toe walked, and my oldest son kept saying, you know, he toe walked, I think you should check that out. So I did finally take him to a PT and said, all right. I didn't realize that his feet couldn't go all the way down. I mean, he could. It looked like it, but that's why he always, what was it? It made sense. Oh, that he always seemed a little off balance, like in sports and stuff. He couldn't quite keep the balance. So she gave us exercises because his wasn't too bad. Actually, my son-in-law is going to be a nurse, and he was the one working for me at the time with William. And so he was really tough on him, more than I would have been. So he would just, because of course William's a boy's boy. Go ahead, give me pain. So they're like working it. And the PT was astonished how much he had changed back in such a short amount of time. Because they said, well, let's try this. And if it doesn't work, we'll do a brace. Which she really thought that we were going to have to do a brace. And he got him back to almost normal. She goes, I've never seen it in like 3 weeks. Because they did these exercises constantly. It's like these different things. So it was a PT oriented, because his never got that bad. Now, Adam, he, and I don't know if, probably can't see it, but I think what happened with his was the same way, but at puberty, he was one that like gained 100 pounds in a foot in a couple years. And I think something happened during that time that they said it's neurological, because all of a sudden it went from him doing that to being deformed into that position. So I actually decided to do surgery when he was 17 or 18, clipped both sides, got it braced, had it almost flat, and within a week it was back. And that's when they said that's neurological, because it wouldn't do that. after all that surgery if it wasn't neurological. And so we tried some neurological tests that they know of. They said there's probably hundreds of more things that could be going on that we don't know about. So I unfortunately put them through all that suffering, because that's the hard thing. You always have to make these decisions, right? As everything has a toll on the family, on the child, on your finances, everything. I decided at that point, because I felt guilty, and we feel guilty all the time, don't we? And it's a hard thing. And so you just have to know that, go by the Spirit, remember that. Here's another quick thing, which is everyone has their path that they're here to learn from. And we can't, it's not going to be a perfect world. It's going to be imperfect. And your child's going to be having an imperfect life, and obviously more seen than others. But we don't get to fix everything. There's no one has a perfect life, not your special needs child, not yourself. And so when you accept that it is what it is, and that there can be happiness in that, and that you can't, that, okay, that's what I'll end with. That's the difference between being an LDS person and a non-LDS person. I sat and watched family after family devastated by the diagnosis of autism, because in their minds, if they did not fix that child, their life was over. Their child's life was over. Their family's life was over. It was just a devastating thing. And they were desperate. I mean, the desperation you would see in other parents, and unhappiness and just strain and stress. And yeah, I want to make my children's life as good as I can help it be. But I know that their life is not over, that their life on earth has its learning to give them and us. And then in the eternities, everything will be okay. And that, why should I feel sorry for Adam? That if we truly believe the gospel to be true, he's in the celestial kingdom. I have to work for it. So who should I be feeling sorry for? Because he's happy. And as my son says, he said he's also ignorant to what other happiness there is to gain on earth. So if his knowledge base is happiness, why should I feel sorry for him when he's made it? And he obviously only needed to learn so much. We have to learn from him and what we need to learn. So I remember a friend of mine who is the desperate person saw in our family a sense of happiness, even as we were working our butts off to help them and do therapies and all that stuff. It's not that we weren't doing that. But she had her daughter come play with my daughter because she saw that the siblings were also fine. And the sibling was very worried and had spoken to her teacher about it, like, my brother is da-da-da, and my mother's all stressed out because they know. And so they played for the afternoon. And, of course, autism didn't get brought up. And her mother had said to her daughter, did you know that Abby has, you know, three brothers with autism? She looked at her like, you do? And Abby says, of course. They're like, doesn't everybody? Because that's the way it was in our family. And it just kind of changed that whole girl's attitude, because she's like seeing this friend of hers like, you know, okay, so yeah, doesn't everyone? You have one, everyone. This is our life. We don't know differently. And it doesn't have to be catastrophic. So remember, the way that you perceive things is being picked up by your family. And when you know that, we're each other's brother's keeper. That's what it's for. If we believe the gospel to be true, then that perspective changes everything. Yes, we're here to help our children progress. Yes, we want them to have as much happiness as they have. But it's not our job to be God. We don't get to be God. And that was a real eye-opener for me. I don't have to trust God. God is in charge of Adam's life, not me. I can be his help however he needs me to be, but I don't get to decide that his perfect or imperfect life and what that looks like. I'm only to be an instrument and to remember the eternal picture. Yeah, what we did is I'd gone to my state president. Everyone had their misgivings, and I know we're going to need to finish up. Everyone had their misgivings. We didn't. You know, Eli, and I had my misgivings because my oldest son, who ended up undiagnosed bipolar on his mission, we didn't realize, went home after a year. It was a very difficult situation for him. He put everything out there and left it all on the mission field, and I got back a very broken child that took about 3 years to build back up. And I didn't want that to happen to Eli. But I had to remind myself, first of all, Eli's not Eric. And so two different children. And Eli, and I told Eli, you know, we're just concerned about, you know, how it's going to emotionally affect you and stuff like that. And he goes, Mom, do you not understand what a mission is for? No, son, tell me. You know, if one person is brought unto God, how great is his joy? It's like, okay, son, okay. Because they're so pure, you know, and so innocent. And that, I think that's what everyone was worried about, is that that would be destroyed. And so I talked to the state president, who at first had his misgivings. I said, listen, we're a very realist family. And I know we're at time, but I'm going to quick finish this. But we're a very realist family. I said, he knows his weaknesses. We talk openly about it. He's aware of what it takes. I already told him, la, 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 la. He wants to do it. And he said, you know, okay, that gives me confidence. We went to the LDS social service thing to get his approval, to get his stamp of approval before we even sent in his papers. So we did that, but then they just automatically see that we had a diagnosis written down. They sent back a test. And so he had to take this test. And I guess he passed enough that they said, okay, we're willing. It was going to be a no, a trial, or a yes. So they said trial. That they required a three-month trial in our local area. So we're from Charlotte Mission is our mission. So he went to the Charlotte Mission and served away from where we live. So we just dropped him off. No MTC first, mind you. So I'm thinking, yeah, they're behind the eight ball right there. I dropped him off, and he did two transfers and did well enough, like I said, that, and I was pleased. And it actually made me feel better. And then he got an official call while he was out there. Then he went to the MTC. Then he went and served the other mission. So I just told Eli my requirement was, you have to tell me truly how everything's going. You don't, because they really emphasize, be positive, be positive. When you write to your missionary, you have to be positive. And when they write to you, only positive things. Well, guess what? That's what my first son did. And by the time I found out things were going south, he was way south. And if he had told me, then I could have helped sooner. And so I told him, your requirement is, if you're starting to have anxiety or you're starting to have panic attacks or anything like that, you are going to tell me. So he does. He tells me, and he's doing really well. And I'm just really pleased with how his companions and everybody has supported him, because my son wondered, will they say, oh, I don't want to be with that kid. I'm going to be stuck with him, you know, and he's special needs. But you know what? I think they all notice that he's got that purity that we're all supposed to have, and they protect that, not as a, you know, he's not capable, but hey, you know, this is something we're all supposed to have, and let's not let him lose it.
LDS Home Educators is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to providing inspiration to homeschool families. We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in listening to more recordings or would like to participate in a future conference, please visit our website at ldshe.org.